from KCPW in Salt Lake City. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Salt Lake City is behind it, Salt Lake County is willing to chip in on the cost, and a high-powered architectural team has been selected. So now we move on to the design phase of the $110 million Utah Performing Arts Center, and expectations are high. UPAC, as it's known, has been billed by its supporters as the anchor for the city's cultural core and an economic catalyst for downtown. So this can't be just any generic structure of glass and steel. It's got to provide a Broadway-style theater experience, but also has to be squeezed into a tight space on Main Street. Today on the program, we're talking about the vision and early ideas for what the new Broadway-style theater should look like. Plus, Utah charities, foundations, and the Great Recession. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The Utah Performing Arts Center is emerging as a centerpiece of a vibrant downtown Salt Lake City. So the big question is, what will the venue look like? City leaders are asking the public to weigh in during the design phase, and today on the program, we're hearing more about the vision for the Utah Performing Arts Center. Joining me in studio is Mike Vella. He is the Associate Principal and Senior Vice President of HKS Architects, an architectural firm with offices in 29 cities worldwide, including here in Salt Lake City. City officials selected HKS as well as Pelly Clark Pelly as the design firms for the new UPAC. And Mike Vella, welcome to you. Thanks so much for your time.
Good morning.
Also with us, Kurt Bester, an Emmy Award-winning composer with scores for feature-length films, television projects, 16 CDs, and of course his Christmas holiday extravaganza. But today he's joining us as the co-founder and co-chair of the group Friends of the UPAC and as a member of the UPAC Design Team Selection Committee. Kurt, welcome to you. Great to see you again.
Good to see you too.
Also with us, Helen Langan is senior advisor to Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker, also was a member of the UPAC Design Team Selection Committee. And Helen, great to see you as well.
Great to see you.
Later on in the program, we get a progress report on how Utah nonprofits are faring. But first, UPAC, what do you want and expect from a new Broadway-style theater downtown? If you've got questions or comments about the design phase of the Utah Performing Arts Center, join our conversation. 801-355-TALK is our number. This question may be settled already, Helen, but I'll address it to you. Tell us again just why Salt Lake City needs a Broadway-style theater, and why now is the right time to build.
Sure. Well, as you know, this concept for a theater dates back all the way to the 1960s and the Second Century Plan, which was created by the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce at that time. And the common theme that has run through the many, many studies and plans since that time and sort of the common motivation has been that this theater concept can uniquely serve as an economic development tool for downtown Salt Lake City and to bring new people downtown and create new jobs and just really become a tool for the expansion of the local economy. So from our standpoint, the concept of the Broadway Theater, while it'll be a wonderful amenity for the arts and culture community, it will also, even if you're never a patron, you'll also experience the benefit of its contribution to the local economy.
Kurt Bester, why are you behind it?
Well, because I saw a need, actually. We keep using the term Broadway style, and I understand why a lot of people say that, but I look at it as filling a niche. As a performer who asks to book halls, I really don't have a dog in this fight, but I have an interest. If you were looking for a hall in Salt Lake City that seats 2,500 people, you could go to Capitol Theater, but on a Friday and Saturday, typically it's the ballet is there or the opera's there. If you're a traveler,
and it's only 1,800 seats.
And it's only 1,800 seats. Or if you want to go to Kingsbury Hall, you've got less seats as well. So typically artists, and I'm talking now musical artists, they fly over Salt Lake City because they don't want to go to the Energy Solutions Center or the Maverick Center. That's the only other thing available. If you want to go to Bravenel Hall, you have to spend tons of money to bring in lights. So we don't have a theater to fit this niche, and I don't think a lot of people know that. So when I found out that it was coming, I kind of made myself available to get involved, and then I was asked to actually officially be involved, and I was tickled pink.
Mm. Helen, why now, though? I mean, why now? Sure. Why is now the right time to build, do you think?
So we've been studying this project over the last four plus years, really since the beginning of Mayor Becker coming to office. When he, as you know, when he first came to office, at the time, another city in Utah was looking at building something outside of downtown. And one of the guiding principles that he had been elected with was the notion that if there's going to be one of something, it ought to be in Utah's capital city and at the heart of our state. And so this project was brought to him really by the Salt Lake Chamber, and they said, we really need an advocate in the mayor's office to research and find out if this is feasible and look at the market. So we did extensive new research. Just to give some perspective, back in 1990, there was a study that was completed by Salt Lake County that said this theater needed to be built within 10 years. So clearly that didn't happen. We're about 12 years past that. And so now, and by the time this is built, we'll have been 16 years past that, actually. So it's been sort of something that there has been latent demand for and need for a long time. The market studies are very clear that there is great need for this. And then really from an economic perspective, it's kind of counterintuitive, but when we're in a down economy, which we have been as we've been looking at this, you want to do projects that when construction rates are low and interest rates are low, that can then stimulate the economy. So it's that whole combination of factors that have really led us to this point of as to why now.
The city announced the selection of HKS Architects and Pelly Clark Pelly back, I believe it was in August. Helen, you were part of that evaluation. What really drew you to HKS Pelly?
Well, we had some amazing proposals. We were so thrilled at the quality of the firms that competed. And so I want to compliment those even that we didn't select. It was a very, very tough decision. But what we really loved about this particular team was they had a wonderful history working together. They had had wonderful experience specific to theaters and had built several of the theaters that they built were actually the very theaters that we had been studying as part of our analysis of this project. And so that spoke to us. We also just liked their working style and their chemistry. There were a lot of things, but ultimately we just were impressed with the quality of their work and the way they put their team together.
Kurt, what do you have to add? I mean, what did they bring to the table?
Well, I think people should understand that the process that to choose a design firm is not just who's can build the prettiest buildings. I mean, everybody that submitted, and if, you know, we call them Starkitects, but these guys that have built some of the best buildings around the world wanted to build here in Salt Lake City. So we're not talking about schlocky stuff, but we also had to find out who could work with our local leaders, who could capture the vision of our arts community, who could build something that was green. That was important, especially to Mayor Becker and his office, who could build something that's going to be forward-leaning in that area. And, you kind of shake it all up. It was quite a lengthy process. It took, I don't know how many months, but quite a few months. And we went through tons of proposals. I felt like I was back in college doing research papers, man. I was reading and studying.
Kurt would show up with highlights.
I did, man. I took this very, very seriously. it had a lot to do with the aesthetic, but it also had to do with the process. So, we can talk about that when we talk about why we chose these guys, because their process was really good, as well as their aesthetic.
Speaking with Kurt Bester, Emmy Award-winning composer as well as performer, he's joining us today as the co-chair of the group Friends of the UPAC, the Utah Performing Arts Center. Also with us, Helen Langan with Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker's office. And joining us now, Mike Vella, the Associate Principal and Senior Vice President of HKS Architects. Mike, why did you want this project?
Oh, this is a phenomenal project. Probably us architecturally, Kurt and I were talking about this before we were on the air. A performing arts center is a wonderful type of project. Of all of the projects that an architect can do, a performing arts center, particularly a downtown performing arts center, is like the cherry of the kind of work that you can do as architects. So it's just a phenomenal building type.
This is nothing new. You've done performing arts venues in addition to things like the Aria Hotel in Las Vegas. I mean, what are some of the guiding principles? I guess for $110 million, people in the public want to know what they're getting, what they're going to buy. Can you give us some of the ideas, the values that you hope this building, this particular building, embodies?
Well, I think the Performing Arts Center, the terms that have been talked about even in the request for proposal, that it be a beacon on Main Street, that it be something that's attractive and very, very visible. So it's not only the performance that Kurt has talked about and Helen has talked about as just the facility, but what it means to downtown Salt Lake, what it means to that entire Arts District community. And it supplements everything else that is within the Arts District. And so now Salt Lake is not a fly-by city with regard to offering venues for all types of shows, big and small, just as Kurt talked about. There's everything is that you would want to see, quote, in a big city is here in Salt Lake.
Salt Lake City, I mean, obviously, we would want this to look like us, you know, to fit into the architecture, the fabric of downtown. What are you thinking? Lots of glass and steel, lots of light. You use the word beacon, modern, traditional, what?
If I could just jump in.
Yes.
One of the big guiding things that we've been telling them, this particular block of Main Street, your question's exactly right, is one of our last remaining historic blocks of Main Street. So we are very interested in seeing a building that complements that really well and has a human scale to it, but yet, as he mentioned, is a beacon and beautiful, but in a way that is very complementary to the historic qualities that are all around it on that block between 1st and 2nd South on Main.
Mike?
And as we've talked about, Mitch Hirsch with Caesar Clark Pelle and me, and talking about what the design looks like, we have no preconceived notions of what it ought to be, but we take our clues from our neighbors to the north and to the south across the street. Downtown Salt Lake.
Who are your neighbors? Can you describe them?
You know, all of the neighbors up and down, you know, the Tribune building, the other buildings, as Helen talked about, this particular block, there are many buildings that have the stone, the terracotta, the brick, all of those kinds of details. And that's the vocabulary that we will start the design with. Now, you have to pay attention to your neighbors up and down the street, for one. And yes, it will be a beacon, but it needs to be the design, as it will evolve with all of the input that we receive from the city, from the people that are coming to the workshops. The design will evolve and be reflective of what happens up and down Main Street, and still satisfy the program requirements for the Performing Arts Center.
I imagine that's something you're looking for, Kurt.
Well, absolutely. As a person who will, I'm sure, perform there, you know, I want it to feel good inside. But when you asked an interesting question, you said, you know, what will it look like us? You know, and it's like, what is us? And us is not a, you know, we don't talk in terms of this is Victorian, this is modern. That's a little provincial, I think, in thinking that way. Us is the mountains. Us is the culture. Us is what we see, but us is what we feel. It's the experience of being a Utah. And as an Utah artist, I'm also a reflection of that. So that's kind of why I feel like I'm in lockstep with this design process, because I also respond to the very same stimuli as the architects.
We're speaking with Kurt Bester, an Emmy Award-winning composer, performer, as well as co-chair of the group Friends of the UPAC, the Utah Performing Arts Center. Also with us, Helen Langen with Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker's office, and Mike Vella, a principal at HKS Architects, the firm that will be designing your new Utah Performing Arts Center. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Next week, I should note, Salt Lake City is hosting the second public workshop with city officials and architects. We'll give you details on that as we go. The Utah Performing Arts Center presents a few unique architectural challenges. I mean, Mike Vella, maybe you can walk us through what some of those challenges are in terms of you know, the technical requirements of a world-class theater space, parking, etc.
Well, thank you. You talk about a performing arts center, and one of the things that has bubbled up in all of our discussions and in our history of what we know performing arts centers, it has to work on two different levels. It has to work for the public, but it also has to work for all of the back of house, all of those functions, all of the things that you don't
getting
see.
Getting the sets in.
At the, you know, every performance hall has a reputation, and the reputation is on the back of house side, how easily can all of the trucks come? And I don't think people know and understand. For a show like Wicked, there's 14 semi-trucks that come with all of the equipment, all of the costumes, everything that makes that show. So it's getting physically all of those trucks in and out of the site. you know, the delivery curtain up, load in, load out, that kind of thing. So that has to work. On the front of house side, it has to be a receptive area for all of the patrons that are coming. It has to be this we like to think of it as a downtown living room for Salt Lake City. So those two programmatic things have to mesh together and work together, hand in glove.
We need to take a break, but we are talking about the early visions of the new Utah Performing Arts Center, what the public expects from this building. Salt Lake City, as I mentioned, is seeking public comment on the center with a workshop coming up next Thursday, October 11th, from 5:30 to 8 p.m. at the Salt Lake City Main Library here on Library Square in the fourth floor conference room. You need to sign up for the workshop, I believe? No, you can just show up.
We'd like you to RCP so we have a sense of numbers, but everyone can show up.
Terrific. Absolutely. Okay. To sign up if you'd like, or for more information, you can check out links on our website, kcpw.org. But if you've got questions or comments about the new Utah Performing Arts Center, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Again, we need to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. As the hub for Salt Lake City's cultural amenities, the Utah Performing Arts Center needs to be a first-class theater space as well as an architectural knockout. Today on the program, we're talking about the early conceptual vision of UPAC with Kurt Bester. He's a member of the group Friends of the UPAC. Also with us, Helen Langen, a senior advisor to Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker, and Mike Vella, a principal at HKS Architects, which will be designing the new facility. If you'd like to join us, you can. 801-355-TALK. Salt Lake City, of course, wants your ideas on UPAC. They're sponsoring a public workshop next Thursday. We'll give you more details on that later. But what do you want to know about UPAC? What do you want from this $110 million project? If you've got questions or comments, certainly call us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Let's go to Bill in Salt Lake City. Bill, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. Go right ahead.
Yes, my question was, first, isn't this sort of like keeping up the Joneses next door to some extent? And my actual question was, is this, with our current economic problems, the best way to spend $110 million?
Bill, what do you mean by keeping up with the Joneses?
Well, you talk about to the north of us, to the south of us, and that we need to have this particular building or center. And I just question the idea of building it right now with the current problems we're having with the economics. Is this the best place to drop $110 million?
Bill, it's a good point. Thanks very much. Kurt Bester.
Yeah, I have an interesting perspective on this. You know, if we were talking about enticing Adobe to come to Utah, which we just did, and we were talking about spending some tax incentives or money spent to entice people to come to our city, we probably wouldn't think twice about it. But because we talk about the arts, we think of it as kind of a fluffy sort of thing. But this particular hall actually has a tremendous money-making potential. Helen could probably speak more to that. But we're not talking about just a fluffy little place to go entertain ourselves. We're talking about a money-making facility, which is unusual in the arts. All the other arts organizations in the town, you know, Utah Symphony and others, rely on some tax help. This is a place where people are going to spend money, yours truly included, to book the hall. I will be putting money into Salt Lake City. So if you view it that way, it's a little different.
The other thing I would add is that, as I mentioned before, this is really an economic driver. And one of the main revenue sources that we're looking at in terms of funding this is a series of downtown economic development funds that are about to retire debt service on the improvements around the Energy Solutions Arena when that was first built, as well as the Salt Palace. And if you, we'll use the Energy Solutions Arena as an example. If you never go to a jazz game, but you may go to Gateway, or you may appreciate how dramatically that neighborhood has transformed over the last 20 plus years as a result of those investments in that redevelopment that's happened. We feel that it's an economic development driver like very few other things you can put investment in. B, that it will have great returns on that neighborhood, and then C, that the studies that we've done leading up to this show that it will create jobs, 116 permanent jobs during construction, upwards of 4,000 jobs during that period, economic expansion. I mean, there's a lot of sort of drivers. As Kurt mentioned with the Adobe example, the thing that I thought of was, think facilities like this are what really create a place people want to move their companies to relocate from other parts of the country. It's where people want to go to live, work, and play. And so it really becomes a driver. We, in some of our early estimates of how many new people that are not currently coming down to downtown Salt Lake City for cultural experiences will be coming as a result of this, and it was well over 150,000. So, I mean, we really see a lot of benefits. And those are people not just going to a show, but going hopefully to a restaurant and shopping. And we also have the advantage of leveraging the development to the north of this, which is the City Creek development. So all the new people that that's drawing will now have another reason to come to downtown Salt Lake City or to stay longer and spend more money.
Bill, are you sold? Yeah, go right ahead.
Yeah, the question is who made a determination or did the survey or whatever that it's going to be an economic driver? The people who want the center or just an impartial third party?
It was an impartial third party that was hired by the city to look at this. And at the time, we were very like, tell us if it's a bad idea. I mean, we really wanted to know one way or the other. And they did the economic impact study and came back, and it showed really great outcomes.
Bill, now that this is sort
of... $110 million for 116 jobs doesn't seem like a really great trade-off to me. So I'll take my answer for that off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
Well, it's, Obviously, those of us that wanted were always trying to look at the upside. But there was, I saw the study that Helen showed in the early as I got involved, because I was a little hesitant to jump in and incur the wrath of my fans who might not want to build something like this. You know, I want everybody to like me. But really, honestly, studying it just made sense. And I think, again, Bill raises questions that a lot of people have raised, saying, is now the time to do it? And ironically, like Helen said earlier, now is actually the best time to do it because interest rates are so low. Construction companies want to help build it. But for me, I see a long-term benefit financially to this area. When you bring in a Broadway show, when you bring in a big act, that's money that's paying off that $110 million. This is a money-making thing. We're not asking for handouts here. Yes, it costs money at the beginning, but later on, it's going to be a commercial hall. It is not the taxpayers aren't going to have to subsidize this hall. This is a money-making facility. Starting from day one when we book a show or we book a big musical act or a comedian or part of our convention, whatever.
And to, if you don't mind me adding a little
very
bit.
Very quickly,
to,
yes.
The way that we've decided to operate this facility, we've partnered with Salt Lake County, who operates the Capitol Theater, Bravenel Hall, and the Rose Wagner, and they will run this as part of a family of those four facilities. And ultimately, the revenue indirectly will go back to Salt Lake, in some part, to go back to Salt Lake County and the Center for the Arts that's running it. So it will actually be a benefit also economically to those facilities, which is another aspect of the project.
Bill, thanks so much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Talking about the Utah Performing Arts Center being planned for a Main Street location. What do you want from this building? 801-355-8255. You mentioned earlier about the 2,500 seats. And I guess that's a question that keeps coming up, too, because, I mean, that's bigger than Lincoln Center in New York City. Does Salt Lake City really need that large of a venue? Helen Langan.
Sure. When you put all of the facilities, the performing arts centers around the country that do these bring the touring commercial shows, you see that 2,500 is actually for the business model of touring shows, which is different from on Broadway traditional. That 2,500 is really the sweet spot, and our firm that did this feasibility study studied that question extensively, and you see anywhere from the low end, which would be less enviable for the tours in the 1,800 seats, to the high end into the 2,600, 2,800. And so 25, even up to 3,000, actually. So 25 sort of right there in the middle. And what we have been educated to understand from the work that's been done to look at this is that really, from an economics standpoint, makes the most sense for this facility. And they can be designed, and that's going to be one of the challenges for Mike and his team. These facilities, we've looked at them around the country, and it's because we don't have a frame of reference here in Utah, it's hard to imagine how that doesn't feel huge, but they can be designed beautifully where they have a real intimate feel, and that's one of the directions that we've given our team, because we certainly want it to have a real warm, embracing quality when you step into the hall.
Well, it's one thing to have a warm, inviting space. It's another to fill those seats.
Right.
Is there the demand?
Absolutely. That's another thing that this comprehensive, the feasibility study we keep referencing, looked at, was the market demand in this market. And it's without question that there's unmet demand right now for this. So, yeah.
Let's go back to the phones. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Richard joins us from Park City. Richard, hi.
Hi. So I came into the discussion a little late. I have season tickets to Pioneer Theater. I guess I'm wondering what the proposed theater offers that, say, Pioneer doesn't, that Broadway doesn't. I did hear the comment on Bravenel, and I understand the lighting concerns. And then secondarily, how many seats are we talking about, and how does it compare size-wise to Pioneer, Broadway, Bravenel?
It's a good question, and one that I this is Kurt Best, by the way. Happy to kind of answer. A Bravenel Hall seats 2,500, something like that, right?
It's about 3,000.
Oh, no, it's not 3,000.
28?
But like you said, it has a specific purpose that if you try to turn it into a Broadway style place, you have to spend thousands of dollars, and I do every year, to bring in lights and so forth. So then you've got Pioneer, Kingsbury Hall, which has and it has a resident theater there that you go to pay to go see. You've got Rose Wagner, who has it's like 600, 800 seats. So this particular theater fits. It's like the missing link in the cadre of theaters that a big town typically has.
And if I could add to that, so Pioneer is a wonderful theater, and it does really great what would be considered really high quality kind of regional theater, and they do many of the same shows as the professional touring Broadway shows, but they don't actually bring professional touring Broadway to that theater, and so that's one key difference. Although sometimes you'll see, you know, they'll do a Les Mis or something like that. So, and I think it's can be confusing. The level. So that's one piece. The other thing is that the size is quite different. I think it's around 900. And so that's another component. And then finally, there's an acoustic issue, which I'll let Mike speak to, that's a little bit different as well.
Every one of the venues has a different acoustic requirement. Opera is significantly different than ballet, significantly different than Broadway. And all three of those come with different requirements, which means that the height, the width, and the acoustic, either the reverberant or the absorptive qualities of the house are different. And so for that, that's one of the reasons why those kinds of things are being included in the Utah Performing Arts Center, so they'll satisfy that need.
Yep. Richard, thank you so much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. I want to get back to the design element. To attract suburbanites, to attract people regionally, you have to have parking. How is parking going to fit into this overall vision? Mike Villa.
We have the luxury on this particular site in Block 70 to have two large parking garages in the middle of the block, for one. The other thing is that we're right between two track stations. So we don't look at it as a single event. We look at it as patrons coming before the show, having the show, and after the show. So a lot of what we're looking and thinking about is not just the Performing Arts Center design, but the master planning of the entire block and what patrons are going to see and feel for that entire evening that they come to the show.
Parking always gives the city, a headache, Helen. I mean, are you going to be able to reassure people that, yes, you can get easy access to this new Performing Arts Center?
I think so, and some of that will come down to the design, too, because as the team, Mike's team is working on looking at the urban context of this site and where those two parking garages that he mentioned are, they're going to be looking at how to make the accessibility from them to the theater a pleasant experience, accessible. And they're not far physically, but you can do things design-wise to help make it even kind of feel more approachable psychologically. Mm-hmm. And it's always interesting because our parking, I always say this, the parking dilemma downtown is far more perception than reality, because when you look at the number of spots, I mean, there are so many spots.
Look at City Creek now. You could park.
My theory, I mean, I think it's sometimes it comes down to, I think people are not as comfortable parking in underground spots or parallel parking. And so sometimes in somebody's mind who doesn't have to parallel park or park in a parking garage often, you sort of opt all those out of your selection of options. And then it feels like there are very few kind of easy to park in spots.
Mm-hmm. But Mike Vella?
The parking garage that's immediately to the east of us is a multi-level above grade parking garage of 2,500 plus parking spaces.
Okay, we're going to have to get more listeners in our limited time. Marty is joining us from Salt Lake City. Marty, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate it. Hi, Kurt. Nice to talk to you again.
Thank you, Marty.
Hey, I'm wondering a couple of things. You touched on one thing. You know, the Capitol's doing a pretty good job bringing in Broadway shows with the Broadway Theater League's involvement. And you've talked about how it'll affect, to an extent, these other venues, but not really specifically. And also, you've only really been talking about public venues. What about venues, you know, like the Depot, which is, of course, smaller seating, or the Venue, places that are bringing in, you know, current pop and rock concerts? Is this someplace that would be, you know, feasible for those kinds of shows as well, or are there any ordinances against that kind of thing? And also, I'm wondering if this gathering you're having at the library is a place that people such as myself who are seeking employment in this venue can come with resumes, et cetera, and perhaps talk to people about getting a job, which is certainly scarce in this area, especially in the arts.
Marty,
other
thanks.
Than that, it's such a fabulous idea. Any great city has a great venue, and we have a Bravenel, and having a sister or a brother venue to that would be so fabulous for this city.
Marty, thank you. You're certainly welcome to bring your business card and resume, but I think it's probably a bit early for that. But do come and give your ideas. These meetings are not perfunctory, they're functional meetings, and these guys are really relying on our arts community as well as the general public to make their input about parking, about how we use the hall and everything else. I just would say to Marty's point that there are lots of arts places, private and public, in Salt Lake City, and all of them will be used. And in a way, everybody's in competition for everybody's dollar. But really, there is a cohesive artistic community, and I would hope that people at Plan B Theater, for example, would want to come and say, you know, we're going to try a special, bigger performance. So let's book this hall and use it. There may be a black box place to perform and rehearse in there that somebody could do. I hope that this will eventually become not a competitive place, but some place that's unifying for the entire arts community. I think that's our plan.
One of the things that the study showed was that it's that rising tide lifts all boats concept. So as you move audiences to a higher level of cultural engagement, that if they, we joke about sometimes Broadway is sort of like a gateway art where it gets them in the habit of going, and then they notice, oh, there's a smaller performance down the street or a musical. And in fact, one of the theaters we looked at, which Pelle designed, the Schuster Center in Dayton, Ohio, they were studying what their brand new Broadway ticket buyers did, what their buying behavior was the year after they had bought their first touring Broadway show ticket. And what they found that was fascinating was that 50% of those people purchased a symphony ticket the next year. So there really is that concept that when you get your audiences back in the habit of coming to live performing arts, it helps everybody. And our studies have shown that, and anecdotally, there are lots of examples of that. And also on the Capitol Theater front, that's a wonderful home venue for some of our most important legacy arts organizations, the Ballet, Ballet West, and the Utah Opera. And one of the challenges with that facility is touring Broadway is the thing that, from a business model standpoint, makes the most money, but it's not the primary mission of that building. So it's always having to be horseshoed in currently around its mission appropriately. But what it does is for the system as a whole, and this is why financially it makes so much sense for the county to run all four facilities, they sort of miss opportunities to capitalize on that revenue, which could then support the other arts groups in their facilities.
Hmm. So. Our time is very short. I want to sneak in Candace, who's been holding from Salt Lake City. Candace, hi. Very quickly.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm just, you know, I'm a young professional, and I really haven't been able to afford a lot of Broadway shows, and I'm really interested in going. And so I'm just kind of wondering, you know, will I be able to afford the tickets? And basically, you know, how is the new theater going to benefit me?
That's a great question, going back to the question of the seat number. With one of the other advantages to that, going from what we have in the Capitol, which is about 1,800 seats up to 2,500 seats, is that now you have a wider range of price points for tickets. And so all of a sudden, every ticket doesn't have to be $100, you know, as it frequently feels like it is when you go to a Wicked or something like that, or more. And that's been sort of one of the things that we've heard through this public engagement process and from our council, to really make sure we think about student tickets and sort of a wide price point. And that's something that will be market driven for sure, but hopefully open up more possibilities. And also because these shows now can come for longer periods of time because they're not competing for schedule. If you have it for more weeks, there's more tickets. It just sort of helps everybody in terms of kind of relaxing the pressure that's created when it's such a tight schedule for a really popular show in a small space.
Candace, thanks for the call. I guess finally, what's going to happen at this workshop on Thursday? Mike Vella, I mean, will we actually get to see something, or are we still just kind of getting ideas?
Well, you'll start to begin seeing things, and a lot of the work that we'll do in the workshop number two is report on everything that we heard, because we heard a phenomenal amount of really good ideas from people in the first workshop. And so, yes, we'll begin to start formalizing and showing exactly what we did here, some of the massing of the building, some of the preliminary planning of the building. Yes, we'll be showing that.
You sure you don't want to just tell us what this is going to look like?
They better not. They don't know what it is.
It's going to look beautiful. I'll just harken back to one of the things that Caesar himself said, is that when we were talking in New Canaan or in New Haven concerning the design, it's a place where people will gather. They will be able to see. There'll be a life, added life to downtown Salt Lake on Main Street. And as with every Caesar Clark Pelley HKS project, at the end of the day, it's going to be wonderful to be there.
Well, we're all waiting with bated breath. Mike Vella, he's an associate principal, senior vice president of HKS Architects. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Kurt Bester, composer, performer, entertainer extraordinaire, as well as co-chair of the group Friends of the UPAC. Kurt, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And Helen Langan, senior advisor to Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker. Helen, thanks.
Thanks, Jennifer.
And if you want to weigh in on the design of the new Utah Performing Arts Center, there is a public workshop next Thursday, October 11th, 5:30 to 8 p.m. at the Salt Lake City Main Library here on Library Square. It's in the fourth floor conference room, and you can find out a lot more through links on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, a new study on the state of Utah nonprofits, but first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. Utah nonprofits took a beating from the Great Recession, and as a result, the local nonprofit sector shrunk 38% since 2009. But nonprofits are still a driving economic force in the state, and those are some of the conclusions of a new report of the state of Utah nonprofits by the Community Foundation of Utah. And today on the program, we're talking with the group's leader about Utah's leaner, meaner nonprofit sector. Joining me in studio is Fraser Nelson. She is executive director of the Community Foundation of Utah, a tax-exempt public charity aimed at increasing the impact of philanthropy and charitable giving. Fraser, it's good to have you here. Thanks again for coming.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
And you can join us as well. What lessons do you think charities and philanthropists can take from the Great Recession? If you work for a local nonprofit, what's been your experience the past few years? You can join us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Fraser Nelson, you surveyed about 300 nonprofits in Utah. You got about 124 responses. What were you hoping to learn?
Well, I think all of us have been anxious to see what the impact of the recession has been. We've certainly opened up our wallets and our hearts to nonprofits. And I think for me, one of the things we thought we'd learn and we have is that for those nonprofits that were fairly marginal entering the recession, they just didn't survive. And for those organizations that entered strong, they have actually done quite well in terms of being able to meet the increase in demand while at the same time seeing, unfortunately, a decrease in donations.
Hmm. Give us a profile, sort of a demographic scale of what Utah nonprofits look like. I mean, what areas are local nonprofits focusing on? How does the local nonprofit stack up with what's going on nationally in philanthropic
sure.
giving?
Well, I think the first thing that is striking in our data is that our nonprofits are really small. We have about 70% of the nonprofits in Utah have revenues of less than $100,000 a year.
How many nonprofits do we have?
We started the recession with almost 6,000, and we're leaving the recession with about 3,000, maybe 4,000.
Wow.
So we've seen a big decline. Now, part of that, we have to admit, is because the IRS wiped its rolls. If you hadn't filed your paperwork in 3 years, the IRS just closed you down. And certainly, there was a big impact of that kind of overhaul of the IRS system. But caught in that were a lot of nonprofits right in the middle of the recession who literally just didn't have any money. Mm. At the beginning of the recession, we saw that, you know, at times as many as half of the nonprofits that we surveyed, because we did these surveys every 6 months or so, had no money in the bank. I mean, they were literally like the families they were serving, living paycheck paycheck to paycheck. And so, unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, some of those organizations just decided it was time to give up. So I think one thing we learned is that our nonprofits are smaller. They are oftentimes focused in different areas than other parts of the country. For example, we have fewer organizations that are focused in health and human services and more that are focused in education. We also have fewer that are focused in religion and faith than the rest of the country. But our organizations are serving just an incredibly important role, especially in the arts and health and human services.
Your report says that nonprofits represent about 5% of the state's workforce. Can you talk a little bit about how nonprofits fit into the larger economic picture? Are they a player?
Oh, absolutely. I think they are a player. I think they are not a recognized player. One of the real challenges of our sector is to get up to the legislature and to let legislators, elected officials, know how important nonprofits are, not only to the economy in terms of, you know, 5% of our state workforce, but also in terms of the services that we provide, that nonprofits provide. You know, when you think about the arts and the schools, I mean, if you just had a conversation, I mean, it's nonprofits that are filling the role that used to be part of our general education program. When you think about, you know, people who are struggling with food, our poverty rate in Utah is increasing. We are really, you know, on the back end of this recession, seeing a big increase in poverty, childhood poverty. It's nonprofits that are really stepping up and serving those folks. And we need to make the case, a strong case for our sector.
We're speaking with Fraser Nelson. She's executive director of the Community Foundation of Utah. They've released a recent report that shows that nonprofits, it's a smaller sector now, but a little stronger. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Nonprofits, they depend on the goodwill of others, both individuals and foundation support, I guess largely. Utah, as you mentioned, ranks very high nationally in terms of charitable giving. But if you take out those religious contributions, Utahns aren't giving quite as much as other peers around the country.
Well, Utahns give at twice the national rate. We give an average of 10.6% of our income. The closest we get is Mississippi at 7.3%. And like Mississippi, much of that money goes to faith organizations. I think one thing that's important to recognize about Utah is our nonprofit sector learned the same lessons many of us did in our own families, which was we got to have some savings. At the beginning of the recession, very few nonprofits had any kind of operating reserve. Those that have come out on the other side, we asked them, what's the number one thing you learned? It's the same thing our family learned. Keep some money in savings. You need it. So the other thing that they've really done differently, and it's because of the difference in our philanthropic landscape, is that 34% of the nonprofits that we surveyed have now created businesses, created ways to generate revenue. Whether they're selling a product or a service, they have found a way to become less dependent on donations. And it's a good thing because those donations are just returning to pre-2008 levels. Mm. So can you imagine, like think about the food bank, think about the Road Home, think about Head Start. They have seen an incredible increase in demand, while at the same time they have seen not a similar increase, in fact, a decrease in donations. So they've learned some very important lessons, and I think we need to really celebrate the strength of our sector.
One thing that your report notes is that the philanthropic, the large foundation community is very, very small here in Utah. There are only a few large foundations that give big chunks of money. And so that makes it a little tricky too.
Yeah, I mean, most of our foundations, like most of our nonprofits, are really quite small. In fact, 73% of them have less than $500,000. I mean, that's not much of a foundation. It's great, but it's not the Eccles. I wish we had 100 Eccles foundations. And many states do. And many states have a very large and significant community foundation. Tulsa, Oklahoma, has $4 billion in its community foundation. Community foundations were started in the 1900s. Ours started in 2009. We were the last state to have a community foundation.
Why do you think that is?
Oh, who knows? Sometimes Utah just does its own thing.
Well, again, can you just explain exactly what the Community Foundation of Utah does? Maybe people don't know enough about you.
I'm sure they don't. I mean, we're a relatively new organization, though a very old concept. Community foundations do three things. They're grant makers. So we have a pool of funds that we make grants from. Secondly, they help other people make grants through donor-advised funds, scholarships, and endowments. We hold assets for this community. We have about $6 million in assets, about 60 funds, different types of funds. And thirdly, we do some convening work. We help people come together to look at a topic. So the thing we've chosen or done the most work in is in this area of social enterprise. And of course, the studies and things like this that help us understand our nonprofit sector.
Okay, so we have a smaller nonprofit sector now than we did 3 years ago. These nonprofits are they have to become more enterprising.
Yep.
What's the way forward? I mean, describe how some local charities are surviving in this very sluggish economy.
Well, one thing is they're being very smart. They are finding ways to be more efficient and more effective, and they're particularly interested in their impact now. You know, the days of just sort of doing a program because you've always done the program, or doing the gala because you've always done the gala, are over. And smart nonprofits have figured out a way to reinvent themselves, make sure, like all entrepreneurs, they're thinking, what is the market need and how do I fill it? So they're creating new programs to address current needs and getting rid of things that really probably aren't as effective, but were always done. Hmm. The other thing they're doing is they're being very smart about the kinds of people they're hiring. Are they hiring people whose skill set match the need? So we're seeing more nonprofits who are outsourcing pieces of their work and really just having in-house the core program folks, and they're outsourcing marketing, whereas before they used to have a marketing director. So they're using community resources more effectively, including volunteers that the Community Foundation is helping them access from the entrepreneurial sector. I think the other thing they're doing is they're watching their dollars. They're investing in their own organization. They are making sure that they have operating capital, and they're looking for ways to earn revenue. And that is, I think, the most important thing that we've learned in this recession is we cannot be dependent on annual giving, on traditional fundraisers, on the auction gala combo. We have to find new ways to bring in dollars. One of the things that we're doing at the Community Foundation is what's called a day of giving, a 24-hour day of giving. In Minnesota, for example, they raise $14 million a year on a single day. Hmm. So on March 22nd of this year, everybody get out your calendars. We're going to have a big day called Love Utah, Give Utah. We're asking every Utahan to give $10, $15, $25 to the nonprofit of their choice and bring in new donors in a new way.
got about 30 seconds left, but I mean, how is this leaving nonprofits feeling? What's the general mood in the sector? Is there optimism out there anywhere?
I think there's if we watch the debates last night, I think there's a combination of, oh my gosh, how much longer can I do this? For some, 24% of our respondents said they were more distressed now than they were at the beginning of the year. At least a quarter are still concerned about the future of their organization. And on the other hand, you have the people who are saying, this is a real opportunity. We've learned a lot. We're moving forward and not looking back. And I think you probably evenly split between the two.
Mm. Fraser Nelson, Executive Director of the Community Foundation of Utah. Fraser, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Coming up tomorrow, it's Politics Up Close with Jeff Robinson. Hope you'll join us for that. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.